from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When California Senator Barbara Boxer made a case in the U.S. Senate in March against drilling for oil in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, she brought to the Senate floor enlarged images of polar bears in the refuge. The photos were taken by Shubhankar Banerjee, our guest tonight. Few photographers could have asked for a better stage tonight on Point, one photographer's journey into the Alaskan wild and into the heart of American environmental politics. We begin in Washington, where Associated Press reporter Matthew Daly has been covering the debate over coastal oil drilling in Alaska and how Shubhankar Banerjee's photographs ended up in the middle of that Washington battle. I asked him to put Banerjee's book of photos in the context of the debate over the future of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Well, I think that the photographer, Mr. Banerjee, I think might even argue that it's not in the context of the debate. He just went out there to show what he considered really beautiful land that has really not been well understood by a lot of people. And he spent a lot of time out there, and more than 14 months, and took a lot of the photos that, you know, he wants to just sort of show people what is out there and kind of preserve in photographs what's there.
But when the book hit Washington, the reaction was political.
Correct. And everything in this town is political. And what happened was that during the debate on the president's plan to drill in the refuge, Senator Barbara Boxer of California, who was an opponent of drilling, held up a enlarged photo from the book and said, people who complain about the refuge and say that it's really just a wasteland, which some of the drilling supporters have been saying, look, there's no reason not to drill here because it's essentially a frozen tundra. Mm-hmm. She was saying, look at the beauty of these photos, and it's not a frozen tundra. And so from that minute on, it kind of became a political subject.
Matthew Daly, where does the debate on ANWR stand right now? What's the most recent vote? What's the future of congressional debate?
Well, the Senate did not approve the drilling, and so it basically is dead on that level for right now. But on the other hand, nothing's ever dead until, you know, the session is over. Senator Ted Stevens, who's the Alaska Republican who chairs the Appropriations Committee, has said that he's going to keep bringing this up until his side wins. He really wants to get this drilling going, and he says it's important for America to develop energy independence. The president has made it a key part of his energy plan, and so you know, really can never say never. The drilling opponents argue that this is kind of one of the last great untouched places on Earth and that it shouldn't be disturbed.
Into this comes a book of photographs. An exhibit from the book opened at the Smithsonian last week, but it didn't open in the manner in which many people anticipated.
Correct. The exhibit was moved to what the photographer believes is a less advantageous spot. It's really kind of in a basement area off behind an escalator. More importantly, from his point of view, the long captions that he had written sort of explaining the various pictures, what the species were or what the mountains were or what, you know, threats they faced, from his point of view, offering a lot of context, were taken out, and they just basically say mountain range and then, you know, the location.
Matthew, what's the history here? Is the Smithsonian political on a regular basis with the exhibits that it shows? Is this something special for this ANWR exhibit?
Well, I mean, they say that they can't be political. They're a federal agency, and they're part of the federal government, and they really can't take a position for or against any legislation. This exhibit is based on a book that Mr. Banerjee has produced, and their position was that they can't really be seen as advocating one way or the other, and so that they would just have the photos speak for themselves.
When the Senate voted 52-48 against going into ANWR, what were the swing votes there, do you know, and what were the swing issues?
Well, some of the key Republicans who voted against it, you know, included Senator Gordon Smith of Oregon, who's a Republican who is, you know, had run last year for reelection on a platform of being sensitive to the environment. And so some of the key votes were people, Republicans, who wanted to be seen as being sensitive to the environment. So that's something that they've been under a lot of pressure from the White House to kind of get in line.
This year is the 100th anniversary of the National Wildlife System. It seems like an odd year for the Smithsonian not to put such an exhibit front and center.
Well, they say they are putting it front and center. In fact, this whole thing is part of the 100th anniversary of the refuge, and they say that if you go to the Smithsonian, this is the Museum of Natural History, which is the second most visited museum in the world, you're going to see this exhibit if you look for it. It is true that where he would have been placed was a more prominent location, but it's not impossible to find. Certainly I found it when I went over there on Friday. So their argument is that they are celebrating it and that it is there for people to look at.
But Ted Stevens, who's head of the Appropriations Committee, was very clear when this vote failed, when the move to go in to drill in the coastal plain failed, that he took this personally. He said, people who vote against this today are voting against me. I will not forget it. Is that kind of statement the kind that can reverberate through Washington? Can it make it to the Smithsonian, or do you think too much is being made out of the
I think it can make it. I mean, I don't think that he necessarily called up the Smithsonian and said, you know, move this to the basement. In fact, I talked to Senator Stevens' office just in the course of reporting a story on it, and they denied, A, that he even knew about the exhibit, and B, that he made a call. And the Smithsonian official who made the change flatly denied that he was pressured by anyone, including Senator Stevens. But that doesn't mean that there isn't sort of this view that, you know, that quote that Senator Stevens had was well known. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible that just on their own, the Smithsonian decided to kind of avoid becoming part of a political controversy.
Matthew, can you remember another instance when a book of photographs got so mixed up in the middle of a hot political debate in Washington?
Really, I guess, you know, Mapplethorpe, but that's been a few years, some of those photos.
Artistic freedom way back.
Yeah, and it's sort of a similar issue. I mean, any time you're talking about the Arctic Refuge, it's political. The subject itself is political, and you're in Washington, so it's political. It sort of will be surprising in a way if it didn't get caught up in politics, because everything in this town does get caught up in politics.
Matthew Daly, thanks for joining us.
Oh, no problem.
Associated Press reporter Matthew Daly, he spoke with me earlier from Washington. Over the better part of 2 years and many miles in sub-zero temperatures and midnight sun, nature photographer Shubhankar Banerjee traversed Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, documenting its remarkable landscape, wild species, and native peoples. He snapped shots of a mother polar bear frolicking with her cubs after emerging from their winter den in frozen March. He documented the births of porcupine caribou. He saw a songbird drinking water in 40 degree below zero weather and fended off his own frostbite on the tundra. His book of photos, out this spring, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Seasons of Life and Land, tells the story of his 4,000-mile journey across the refuge, but it is a political book, too. I want to see official permanent wilderness designation for the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Banerjee says of his mission. The book's release this spring came as the Senate debated and defeated for now the president's attempt to add oil drilling in the refuge to the federal budget bill. What will America ultimately do here? Will the country ultimately resist drilling in the Alaskan Arctic? How do you vote for more oil in the pipelines or more protection of wild areas? And how much more are you willing to pay to heat your home, to drive your car, to protect polar bear and caribou in the Alaskan wild? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Shubhankar Banerjee, nature photographer, originally from Calcutta, India, and author of Seasons of Life and Land. Good evening and welcome, Shubhankar Banerjee.
Thank you, Tom.
It's great to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, so what a story you've got. A kid who grows up in Calcutta ends up month after month after month in the Alaskan Arctic, shooting the most incredible range and display of photographs that I've ever seen of that particular part of the world. Give it to us in brief. How did you end up from way down there to way up there? What's your life track been here?
Very quickly, what happened is when I was a child in India, I was a painter. I came to the United States to do my graduate studies, finished a master's
in physics and
computer science.
Mm-hmm.
But I landed up from Calcutta to the wide open spaces of the Southwest.
You were in New Mexico.
New Mexico. And fell in love with the wide open spaces, got involved in the issues of conservation and the outdoors. And from that point on, over a period of the 10 years that I was trying to figure out a career where I could combine my love for the outdoors and my passion for art into a sustainable career for conservation. So this project is kind of an outgrowth for 10 years' dreams.
And whatever got you all the way up to the very north coast of Alaska? Because, of course, we're talking here about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The acronym is ANWR. It's that nice big chunk of land right up there in the northeast corner of Alaska.
Very northeast corner.
Very northeast corner with Canada on its east, with drilled oil fields at the west, with the Brooks Range as its southern kind of tier, and, of course, the northern sea on its north. You don't just get there by accident.
No, what happened in my case is that I left my job at Boeing And I was looking.
You were up in Seattle at Boeing Aircraft Company.
I was up in Seattle, Boeing Aircraft Company, working as a scientist there. Mm-hmm. And I left my job looking for a project where I could come do something like this. And then I was arbitrarily traveling from Florida to the Canadian Rockies, went to Churchill, Manitoba in Canada mm-hmm. to photograph polar bears, mm-hmm. came back disappointed. I saw polar bears. I photographed great, got great pictures of polar bears. But the experience was not what I was looking for.
You were
for.
With some kind of tour.
Yeah,
and you
it was
were
a tour.
Among a thousand other shutterbugs who were cooking
exactly.
up these polar bears.
Exactly. And so I was looking for a place where I could live with the bears in a totally untrammeled place by tourism or industry. Northern Alaska seemed like a possible place. So I started communicating with the biologist of the Arctic Refuge, and they started sending me these large documents, biological documents, and I was completely blown away by the biodiversity. I had not even imagined something like that could be existing in such a harsh environment. And then I also, of course, read a lot of books on the Arctic, including Barry Lopez's Arctic Dreams. And having come from Calcutta, opposites attract. So Arctic always intrigued me. So combination of those things, I landed up in the Arctic Refuge.
You know, your photographs speak so eloquently and powerfully. I mean, you show the vastness of this terrain. At the same time, you show the intimacy, the vastness with the these huge tracts of land from the sea in toward the mountains. In summer, in actually winter, spring, fall, you've got all the seasons here. And long, long rivers of caribou crossing this terrain, the tundra, and great, just vast flocks of birds migrating in and out. Then in the intimacy, you show, you know, very tight shots of polar bear mothers and cubs, of birds finding their nesting place there. I have to say I've got a special connection. This really resonated with me. When I was a very young man, in the early days of the oil pipeline, I spent quite a bit of time, actually, up on the north slope of Alaska, on the tundra here working, and then also in the Yukon in the summer and in the winter. It is a landscape that's not easy to describe in words to people who haven't been there. The vastness of it is so great, it really trumps any scale I've experienced anywhere else. When people say, what's it like on the north slope, how do you begin to describe it when you don't have your book full of photographs handy?
You articulated it very well, that it's an extremely vast landscape that we have almost forgot that our nation already has. Like, you go to Yellowstone, lots of wildlife, but the animals don't have this massive space to roam around. Like, the grizzlies don't have the space that they need. Polar bears don't have the space they need. This is the place where you see massive vastness, and each of these large mammals and other animals have the place that they need to successfully survive in the environment. So this is an amazing landscape that sustains this remarkable diversity of wildlife that many people may not know, that the Arctic Refuge is the only conservation in the area in the entire circumpolar north that hosts the largest number of plants and animal species, and also the only conservation area in the circumpolar north that has all the Arctic and subarctic ecoregions.
So hardly a frozen wasteland. I wonder how you felt, Shubhankar, when you first made your way there. I know I felt, day after day out on that tundra, absolutely dwarfed by this landscape.
It makes
never
you
felt
humble.
Even more radically humble. I mean, you feel minute. You feel, I felt like that single molecule in a vast organism, just practically lost. It must, for photography, be an overwhelming challenge at the beginning. I mean, is there a wide-angle lens big enough to capture that?
Not really, because for my case, I had to come up with a way, how am I going to photograph this place? And I just let the land speak for itself. I never had any plan. I had no pressure from an editor or a producer to come back with certain kinds of images. I traveled with my guide over a period of four seasons, as you mentioned, 4,000 miles. And whatever I was observing, I was photographing. I had certain things that I wanted to photograph, but I never let that take over. It's the land. I let the land speak for itself.
And I should point out that though our Associated Press correspondent said otherwise at the top of this hour, you were politically motivated in your photography here. You knew that this land, this refuge, was under threat of oil exploration and oil drilling. And from the very beginning, as your publisher points out, you saw it as your mission to bring back photographs that might forestall that. We're going to come back and look and talk in some depth at the photographs of Shubhankar Banerjee and his new book, Seasons of Life and Land. You can view photographs from this astounding collection on our website at onpointradio.org. We're looking tonight at the political journey, a political journey into the Alaskan Arctic, a photographer's bid to save a wilderness. You can join the conversation. Will America be ultimately able to resist drilling in the entire Alaskan Arctic? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a political journey into the Alaskan Arctic, a photographer's bid to save a wilderness with his work. My guest is Shubhankar Banerjee. He's a nature photographer originally from Calcutta, India. He is the photographer who's behind a remarkable book, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Seasons of Life and Land, that is both an incredible depiction of what some have characterized wrongly as a frozen wasteland and, it turned out, a highly political collection of photographs that ended up right smack dab in the middle of the recent Senate debate on whether or not this land in the northeast corner of Alaska, right up along the Northern Sea, should be opened for oil drilling. You can join this conversation. How do you vote? For more oil in the pipeline or for wilderness, for undisturbed caribou, muskox, polar bears? Can we have big SUVs, high horsepower, and Arctic wilderness? And is wilderness, for its own sake, of value to you? Is it of value to the nation? If you never set foot in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, does it still matter to you? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Shubhankar Banerjee, take us with you on your first steps into this landscape, this terrain. What season did you first arrive in, and what did you see? Give us your first responses.
I landed up on March 19th at Kaktovik, and my guide took me on a stroll on the Arctic Ocean. It happened to be the coldest day of the season.
So we're talking very cold.
Very cold. That evening, I went with him on a little snowmobile ride, and the wind picked up about 30, 40 miles per hour. So you're talking wind chill that was 70, 80 degrees below zero. So I was wondering, what am I doing out here? I have gotten myself over my head. I need to go back.
And, but of course, on March 19th, it's solid white as far as the eye
white,
can see.
Absolutely.
And the tundra, flat. And you probably can't even see where it joins the sea at that time of year.
Absolutely. It's completely frozen landscape all the way from the mountain to the ocean. Mm-hmm. And I trusted him and his wife, and they reassured me that things will get worse, but you'll get used to it and you'll live. And I slowly made one baby step at a time and learned how to work and live in this Arctic icebox. Over those snow-covered months, mm-hmm. I photographed a polar bear mother with cubs coming out of their den, mm-hmm. and I was on a 29-day trip to do that. Mm-hmm. And I photographed muskox baby born on this snow, completely snow-covered tundra. I saw seven species of birds that live on the north slope of the Alaskan Arctic, and I photographed several of those species, including the American dipper that you mentioned that live there all winter long and needs open water to feed, and there is open water in 50 below zero. That was the biggest surprise I had.
This was the bird that was drinking at 50 below zero. Where did it find open water? And you're talking open fresh water here, I guess.
Yes, you're talking open fresh water. This is the river. So what happens is that because of deep underground sources mm-hmm. and the warm springs, you have this open water that exists, like the water temperature could be 40 degrees, whereas mm-hmm. the air temperature could be 50 below zero. So it's a unique geologic thing that's possible.
And you're making the point of all this life in deep winter still.
It is
in the
deep
far north
winter.
Because, of course, the debate, the point that's been made by advocates of drilling is that 9 months a year during the long, long period where it is essentially frozen, there's nothing going on up here biologically. And you're making photographically a counterpoint, a counterargument.
Not only do life lives up there or thrives up there, there is new life is born. Like I mentioned, the muskox and the polar bear. Those mm-hmm. things are born all through winter months.
Shubhankar Banerjee, what did you think when your book ended up in the middle of this political debate in Washington? Your images of the polar bear held up by Barbara Boxer on the floor of the U.S. Senate, the thing, the folks are kind of angry about all this, and the Smithsonian apparently sort of shunting your exhibit a bit to the side after the political heat. Did you expect that?
The thing is that, as you know, this book does take a stand that we would like to have this place preserved for all future generations. My images were previously used, not just this year, in the previous years, mm-hmm. in Senate debate and other press conferences and things like that. So I wasn't quite surprised that that's happened. However, what I was surprised at is that the exhibition did not have a political content in it whatsoever.
That is, your captions were sort of deracinated, were cut down so that the sort of emotive, politically passionate voice of Shubhankar Banerjee that was in your captions was essentially removed.
Yes, but the captions did not have any political content whatsoever. These were either journeys from my journal or the other contributors from the Brook. So this was more of a poetic stand that the captions came.
But I suppose any passion for this wildlife, for this landscape, could be interpreted as political at this point.
Pretty much. And in fact, those captions were actually initially suggested by Smithsonian to be done that way rather than us doing it.
Right. So they wanted the color until they didn't, until they wanted it just flat as a tundra.
Exactly. Flat as a tundra.
Oh, boy. Take us into some of the moments. I guess I'm interested in that first winter when you photographed. You've got a photograph of muskox not only winter. I think I see summer photographs here as well. Great, burly, super abundantly, I don't know, is it, what do you call it, fur or hair, Pleistocene kind of creatures. Where did you find them? What's their habitat in that vast tundra?
It took me 600 miles to see the first muskox. Robert and I were traveling, and the first time I saw them was on a hillside along the Hula Hula River, and they were grazing on this exposed vegetation. That was April, deep winter still. Mm. And that was my first sight, and I was absolutely blown away.
How big a group? Do they travel in a herd?
In the wintertime, they do in small groups. That herd was about 9 animals in that, but I have seen herd that as large as 14, but I hear there are herds that could be up to 50, 60 animals in one group. In the winter, they come together. In summertime, they then spread out.
These great shaggy beasts, did they acknowledge your presence? Were you close enough that they were aware of you?
Robert and I are extremely careful about not disturbing the animals, especially during their calving or birthing time when they're very sensitive. So we maintained our distance. We built our own ice blind, like building out of snow. We created ice blinds and kind of waited and watched them from behind. If you look at the photographs in my book, hardly you see animals looking straight towards me. So I kind of avoid that intentionally because for me, intimate shots are not necessarily important. There are many, many intimate shots out there. So I'm more looking for the environmental type of photographs.
And what about the challenges of deep sub-zero photography to your equipment, to your fingertips, to your toes, to steam on the lenses? I mean, just keeping steam, human breath and steam off of glass up there is a real challenge.
It was an extreme challenge, and for somebody who had not survived in that temperature. So anyway, what I used is very old camera bodies, more mechanical bodies, nothing with the latest electronics. Those things work. And in the cold, photographing from the camera standpoint is okay if you can keep the battery warm and the film very slowly rewind so that it doesn't break because it becomes very brittle. Other than that, all of my camera bodies and film and everything was outside, so I never had to worry about this. Fogging up, yes, I needed to be very careful not coming too close to the lens because I would fog up right away and that would be very hard to take out. But some of the weather that I survived was just unbelievable, so...
Yeah, I can well imagine. I guess in part, I know it firsthand, summer and winter, I mean, both can be quite incredible. Midnight sun, and you've got beautiful examples of that here, and then that winter where the wind just howls and it goes so deep. We're talking with Shubhankar Banerjee tonight. He's a nature photographer originally from Calcutta, India, who has put together what may be the definitive collection of photographs of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which, of course, is an area of great debate over whether or not there should be oil drilling there. A lot of callers want to join us. You can join us as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jim is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, and good evening to both of you.
Good evening.
Good evening.
And I just want to congratulate your guest for having such a great work for us to see, and I'm going to buy it as soon as I get to the bookstore.
Thank you.
I am for exploration, but with, of course, tough controls. And let me just explain it with just two lines here. I think the technology is available where recovery can be done with little oil spills. But the reason I'm for it is this country, the United States, is the largest consumer of hydrocarbons. And we go far and wide to get that, such as the Niger Delta, where they, you see these giant oil flares, and which pose health problems to the people.
Terrible health problems there, mm-hmm. yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Colombia, Equatorial Forest, the Uwa people, frequent oil spills. And so I think it's only fair, and I think it's moral, that we ought to extract all the oil that's on our land, of course, with environmental controls, but otherwise it smacks of NIMBYism. So I am
not in my backyard. But Jim, are you saying then, if we're going to despoil every other corner of the planet to get oil, we should despoil Alaska as well, or we don't need to despoil it to get the oil?
What I'm saying is, we ought to at least. I'm going to turn this around. We should at least employ these same standards in other countries, meaning in the Niger Delta. Use the same standards that we're using for the Alaskan wildlife refuge.
Ooh, that's a tough standard, Shivankar.
Jim, the only thing to point out is that it comes across on the media very little that in the Alaskan Arctic, 95% of the Alaskan Arctic coast is open for oil exploration. Just this year, beginning of the year, Congress approved 9 million acres of land for leasing in the adjacent National Petroleum Reserve. So we are talking about preserving the last 5% of that coast, which truly is the biological heart of this magnificent wilderness. So it's not that every part of Alaska should be taken out from drilling.
Jim, thanks for your call. But you must, of course, know that in Alaska, there's an awful lot of support for drilling here.
Yes,
The argument is made, well, there's several kinds of arguments. There's one which is just kind of rough and ready. Hey, we need the resources. We need the oil. Let's not be so, you know, mamby-pamby about it. Let's get in there. There's another which says, Jim is referring to this, with contemporary technology, we can go and leave a very small footprint. We don't need to disturb the wildlife in this area. Having spent as much time as you have in Anwar, can you imagine oil drilling, oil extraction going on successfully here without disrupting the biology you witnessed?
I really do not think so. The reason I say that, even the latest oil fields like Alpine and other places, these latest technologies have been deployed, and you see the environmental impacts they have caused. But beyond that, let me point out one very important fact. The Arctic refuge, coastal tundra versus Prudhoe Bay and other parts of the Alaskan Arctic, is that out here, that tundra is very narrow, between 12 and 40 miles wide, whereas in Prudhoe Bay and on mm-hmm. west, it's 150 miles wide. So you're talking about a very narrow piece of land.
It's true. When you stand, and I've stood there on that northern coast, and you look inland, the mountains are right there. You wouldn't want to have to walk it. It's a long way, but you can clearly see the width is quite finite of the
inside plain. The refuge, if you look at the map, quite mm-hmm. clearly, inside the refuge is very narrow. So mm-hmm. if these animals are disturbed, and even Prudhoe Bay has proved that the caribou were disturbed, that calving area was disturbed, even though the population has grown, but their calving was disturbed. Inside the refuge, if their calving is disturbed, they have no place to go, essentially, to move back into the mountains.
Brad's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Brad, you on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I used to be a salmon fisherman in Homer, Alaska, and I was fishing commercially when the oil spill happened. And,
on the southern coast there.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of miles away.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Hundreds of miles away from Valdez, where the oil gets loaded,
right.
And hundreds of miles away from the North Slope,
mm-hmm.
the opposite side of Alaska.
Yep.
So when that oil spill happened, it altered the commercial fishing industry for salmon in the state very dramatically, and it's still altered today.
So what do you take away from that, Brad?
Well, I take away that the big business and big oil definitely had an impact on what and how I used to make my living and how a lot of people I know used to make their living. And there are still quite a few doing it, but it's a different industry now.
What does it tell you about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that there should be drilling there or not?
I don't believe there should be. I think this country needs a strong conservation effort towards, the miles per gallon in cars and other use of the
Thank you, Brad, for pointing that out, that it's actually almost disturbs me that we are not willing to increase the fuel efficiency of these vehicles by just few miles per gallon, and that's getting defeated in Congress time and time again. And
in fact, we read over the weekend that over the last 20, 25 years, the average fuel efficiency of American cars has gotten worse, not better.
That's right. So thank you for pointing that out, that we really need to look at that. Like the estimate that USGS gave is that if we just increase the fuel efficiency by 3 more miles per gallon for the SUVs, we don't even need to drill in the refuge. So,
Brad, thanks very much for your call, and I hope those salmon come back so you can catch a few more. Shubhankar Banerjee, give us some more of your stories of approaching this wildlife. It's wonderful to imagine, and I want to keep the visuals going here because they're so tremendous. I mean, it's the scale which is astonishing here. The sky always knocked me down.
It's
almost a full hemisphere of sky when you're standing on that tundra.
It's really
a complete bowl.
Yeah, it's a complete bowl, and it's so clean. It's so clear.
Absolutely.
I'll take you through a small journey, which is one of my most memorable experiences, to photograph the polar bear with these two tiny cubs on a den on the Canning River Delta.
Mm-hmm.
My guide, Robert Thompson, and I camped out for 29 days with one break in between for food and fuel. Out of those 29 days, we had blizzard blowing 25 days, only 4 days break. And in one day, we saw the bear with the two cubs play outside the den for 20 minutes.
Did you know that the den was there? Or was it
Yes.
So you had camped purposely near enough to the den that you would see them come out?
And then we would walk, right.
Right. But you also photographed the bear out on the ice, I think, feeding on a seal, if I'm...
Yes, it was actually a whale remain.
Whale remain, but it was near the coast. It was very near the sea.
Exactly. It was on a lagoon. Mm-hmm. That other picture you're referring to was on a lagoon. So I photographed polar bears on different habitats out there.
Mm. I think the makeup of that tundra is mysterious to many people. It's such a marsh. It looks like just a great meadow, but in fact, as you well know, it's absolutely chock-a-block with little rivulets and streams. You can't walk 6 feet it's a maze, just little hillocks of soil, of earth, and lots and lots and lots of water.
And life.
And life.
Absolutely.
In the summertime, including mosquitoes, which will practically... literally eat you to pieces if you, in the summer. How did you deal with that?
They do. And it is the mosquitoes that bring birds from all 6 continents and all 50 states of the United States to nest there. How did I deal with the mosquitoes? My guide said, don't worry about it. Let them bite you for a while and then you'll get used to it.
Oh, that's a real native.
I didn't quite do that. I had to deal with some nets and some little bit of bug repellent.
But you did capture, and I guess from the air, some of these really impressive photographs of birds, just mile after mile, huge flocks of birds coming in to feed on that huge feast of mosquitoes. What breeds did you find?
What breeds?
Yeah.
I have found probably nearly 100 species. I mean, on the coastal side, I'm looking at lots of ducks and geese, various kinds, long-tailed duck, merganser, the rare buff-breasted sandpiper, beard sandpiper, pectoral sandpiper.
And loons, coming from 6 continents,
Six
you
continents and all 50 states of our country. So in a way, like David Sibley, who writes in the book, that this place is connected to us all from all over the world, that these animals are coming. So in a way, if we disturb this place, we do not even know what impact it would have worldwide in these other regions. And this one bird I photographed, buff-breasted sandpiper, doing a courtship display, they have a tiny world population, and this is their nesting habitat. So I was extremely lucky to see it even.
Talk about phenoms. Here we have the photographer starts out in Calcutta, ends up in the Arctic on a political journey into the Alaskan Arctic. We're talking tonight about one photographer's bid to save a wilderness and the photographs that just may have helped do that. What do you think? If you'll never set foot in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, does it still matter to you? And what's your question for the photographer who shot the Arctic for nearly 2 years? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a political journey into the Alaskan Arctic, one photographer's bid to save a wilderness. My guest is Shubhankar Banerjee. He's a nature photographer originally from Calcutta, India, and author of The Photographer Behind Seasons of Life and Land, a spectacular collection of photographs of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You can join the conversation as well. How do you vote for more oil in the pipeline or for undisturbed caribou, muskox, polar bears? Is wilderness for its own sake of value to you? Is it of value to the nation? And where should the national priority lie, with the wilderness or with more oil? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ted's calling from Boston. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
The comment I wanted to make, I am a former professional photographer, so I commend this gentleman on his work, and I think it's a noble effort. I hope it continues to succeed.
Thank you, Ted.
I wanted to just say that, to me, obviously, this is just there's so much symbolism here, both for both parties. Victory is sort of the critical thing here. And I think it's important to recognize that although everyone recognizes there's so little oil there, I mean, I think it's a 60-day supply, from what I understand, that really I think it's about this very cynical approach of trying to, you know, to create a death blow, if you will, for the whole environmental ethic and environmental movement in this country by saying that here's something that symbolizes the last bastion of wilderness in our country that's really untouched and take that away from the people. And to me, it's much more than saving the wildlife. It's saving, it is saving the web that we all depend upon for our health.
Ted, and, we've got it. And I thank you for your call. And of course, this is nothing like the amount of oil that would the United States would need to fuel itself for a long time. It may be a bit more than 60 days, but it's a tiny percentage of what the nation consumes. But Ted goes to something here, Shubhankar Banerjee, and I wonder what you think of it, about motivations. Now, on the one side, your book is deeply supported by foundations and groups who are committed to environmental protection. And you've got essays from them throughout the book, including former President Jimmy Carter, who was instrumental in ANWR's creation in the first place. You've got William Meadows, who is the president of the Wilderness Society, quoting Ralph Waldo Emerson, talking about wilderness for its own sake, saying, called wilderness the uncontained and immortal beauty for the simple reason that it's free. There's in here more than an argument for preserving this biological habitat. It's an argument even for wilderness itself. How do you perceive the other side of the argument? Are you as jaundiced about it as Ted, who says there are people who just want to knock it down for the sake of knocking it down so that the whole wilderness kind of preserve idea is done and finished with?
I'll point out one quick thing, Ted, that Ted brought up. When Grand Canyon National Park was being proposed, Grand Canyon National Park does not have much of wildlife, and the opponents were saying what can be there in this place. The only thing we can do in this park is mine for copper mining. And when Florida Everglades was being proposed, the opponents were saying that what can be there in a swamp? Those places were preserved for the very fact that these are wild places that need to be preserved to renew our soul. And that's what William Meadows talks about in his essay, is that Arctic Refuge is such a place and much beyond. So I do agree with Ted's point of view that there are certain places that just needs to be preserved for the land itself.
So having spent as much time there as you have behind the camera lens, how do you interpret the motivations of people who want to go on and drill in ANWR?
It's truly, to me, it is disgusting that we would even think about doing something like that when other 95% of the Arctic coast is actually open for drilling. So it's almost taking away something from the future generation that we may drill today. We put all these pipelines and everything and get 6 months supply of oil or whatever there may be. But we are robbing something from our future generation.
Ted, thanks for your call. Al is calling from Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I wanted to echo some of the things your previous caller said. I'm also an Alaskan resident out on the East Coast. In the military, going to graduate school.
Got it.
And my wife grew up in Alaska. We also represent that minority that supports keeping ANWR closed. And often the debate is about whether you can do it safely or whether you can't. And I think that kind of misses the point, because I think it boils down to, there's got to be limits. And people have alluded to this, and that, you know, even if you do drill there and you do it safely, you know, it symbolizes something. It symbolizes the fact that there aren't any limits. And my question is, do you think President Bush has started to get that message as signaled by his budget proposal for alternative fuels? Albeit small, it seems to be the first sign in that direction.
You're talking about Al in the State of the Union speech where he's calling for hydrogen-powered fuel cells, hydrogen-powered automobiles?
Right, and I understand it actually got into the budget for this sort of thing. And my question is, do you think they're connected? Because I see somewhat of a connection in the sense that on the one side, if you want to call them environmentalists, have gotten the message across to a certain extent that that sort of language coming from a very conservative president is significant.
Al, I'll have Shubhankar address that, but before I go to him, interpret for us, if you will, as an Alaskan, the very broad and deep support for drilling in Alaska. How do you interpret it? What do your fellow Alaskans say about Anwar?
I think it's a very practical argument. I think for them it is a matter of jobs. The state is definitely hurting. Sources of revenue are not around every corner. I think it's a very, very practical argument, and it's certainly one I have a lot of empathy for. And it's also, to a certain extent, it's a state's right issue, and that fits in with the whole agenda here as well, is, more control to the states, even though it's federal land, of
right.
course.
And for all that, you're saying, let's show some restraint. Shubhankar Banerjee and Al, thanks for your call. What about it? Al is wondering if the Bush administration is turning a corner. Now, they didn't succeed in getting into Anwar this last time. On the other hand, just in the last couple of weeks, there have been more wilderness lands opened up, as far as I know. Do you feel any diminution of the push to get into the Arctic refuge?
This is what I see, is that while it is commendable that President talks about the hydrogen-powered car, but the same thing, Congress at the same time defeated the CAFE standards, which is increasing the fuel efficiency of our vehicles. So it's a kind of a confusing message, but you're right that President made that effort. On top of that, just last Saturday, New York Times reported that more than 265 million acres of land was kind of opened up without any kind of a wilderness type of review process, that any mining, drilling, anything can happen on these wilderness areas. And no more wilderness in Alaska. So these are kind of mixed messages. But you are right. Probably all the effort that the environmental community is doing is coming across.
Shubhankar
Banerjee, I would hope so.
Take us back to that North Slope before you leave us. Give us a moment that stands out in your mind from the collection of all these astonishing photographs, a moment when you felt the power of that wilderness.
I was sitting there inside a tent observing a small band of caribou. And they were through the fog. I saw this small band with maybe three calves or something, very thick fog. That was June 3rd or June 4th. Few days later on June 9th, I saw every cow had a calf with her. Few were taken away by a grizzly or a wolf. And I began to realize why the Gwich'in people regard this place as the sacred place where life begins.
You described the Gwich'in, that's the people who live in this area, as believing that the humans and the caribou share a piece of each other's heart.
That's precisely true. And I've lived with these people over my extended journey up there. And they really do. They consider the land as themselves. They consider the river as the blood flowing through their stream. And it's kind of amazing, the relationship that these people have with the animals.
You quote Terry Tempest Williams, a poem at the end of the book called Wild Mercy. It says, "The eyes of the future are looking back at us, and they are praying for us to see beyond our own time. They are kneeling with clasped hands that we might act with restraint, leaving room for the life that is destined to come." Shubhankar Banerjee, thank you so much for all that you've shown us in the book.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here on your show.
Shubhankar Banerjee is the photographer behind Seasons of Life and Land. You can continue the conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. Photos there as well. In a moment, secret Senate hearings led by Joseph McCarthy are unveiled after 50 years. This is On Point.
When they say you don't treat them like gentlemen, while we do, I might say that if we did not, I would not cry for them. Traitors are not gentlemen, my good friends. They don't understand being treated like gentlemen.
Loathed by his congressional colleagues and feared for his brutal investigation of un-American activities, Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy rode high on America's Red Scare, culminating in the televised Army-McCarthy hearings of 1954. His persecution of genuine and invented communists was censured by senators later that year. But his name endures, synonymous with paranoid inquisition and the trampling of individual rights in the name of national security. New light was shed today on this dark period of the Cold War. After 50 years, the Senate unsealed 4,000 pages of closed-door transcripts from the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, chaired by McCarthy. Dr. Donald Ritchie is a Senate historian who edited the transcripts from the 1953 and 1954 sessions. In this radio diary, Dr. Ritchie talks about the man whose campaign riveted America and the closed-door sessions that no one heard until now.
People look back on McCarthy, and they've seen the old kinescopes, and they've seen the old newsreels. He did a lot of what he was doing in public, and you think, well, if there were so many public hearings, why did he hold closed-door hearings? Senator McCarthy held these sort of as dress rehearsals for what was going to go on in the public hearings. He was meeting the witnesses for the first time. In some cases, there were mistaken identities. They'd called the wrong person. In some cases, he knew nothing about these individuals except that there had been some vague allegations made against them. He was trying to interrogate them to find out what it was about them, to get them to perjure themselves, perhaps, or to contradict themselves, or to contradict other witnesses, helped to build a case that he could then present in public. Out of the 500 witnesses, about a third did not testify in public session. Some of them because they were mistaken identities, some of them because there just was no evidence at all against them. Some of them actually presented themselves very well in the closed session. They defended themselves, they articulated their positions, and Senator McCarthy, I think, chose not to call them into public session because they wouldn't look bad in public session. They would stand up to him, and he wasn't interested in that kind of a witness. So he was clearly winnowing out the larger body to decide which person would appear best, in a sense, before the television cameras in the public hearings. The biggest challenge for me in editing McCarthy's papers was to separate McCarthy from McCarthyism. Even though Joe McCarthy came fairly late to the anti-communist movement, he gave his name to the entire movement. And so today, as we look back, we assume that Joe McCarthy had something to do with the House Un-American Activities Committee. He had nothing to do with them. We assume he had something to do with the Hollywood investigations. He had nothing to do with that. We assume he had something to do with the Alger Hiss prosecution. He had nothing to do with that. We assume he had something to do with the Julius Rosenberg prosecution. He had nothing to do with that. He did, in fact, begin his program after much of that had taken place. Something about McCarthy personalized that whole anti-communist hysteria into one individual. The name McCarthyism means something to everybody. It's still used in our political discourse, and it still means abuse of witnesses, of smears, of guilt by associations, in a sense of improper behavior. And in that sense, the legacy of Senator McCarthy is that investigations, as important as they are, have to abide by the rules. Throughout American history, there are these periods. You can go back to the 1790s and look at the Alien and Sedition Acts and find the same type of anxieties and fears and concerns. And you can come right on up to our present day and realize that this tension between national security and civil liberties is sort of always present. It's a matter of balancing one against the other. It's partly due to how much information we have. And quite often, it's the lack of information that creates great public anxiety and great fears. And it seems to me that the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations has really done a public service in opening up these records so we can see what happened at that really critical time when civil liberties and national security clashed so dramatically, and how we have acted since then to try to assure that that won't happen again. And yet, of course, we know that the struggle between national security and civil liberties continues right on to today.
Donald Ritchie is an historian at the U.S. Senate Historical Office. To read McCarthy's executive session transcripts, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.